Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Parliamentary Library Lecture today. I'm Roxanne Missingham, I'm the Parliamentary Librarian, and the Parliamentary Library Lecture is a series we instituted this year to enable us to have speakers to present in detail on a relatively complex issue in a way that meant that members and senators and their staff and other library clients could engage in a discussion on something that was more complex than the sort of issues we've often been describing through presentations at Vital Issues seminars. This is our third Parliamentary Library Lecture on stem cell policy and science issues, and we've chosen this issue to have a number of Parliamentary Library Lectures rather than just one, because it's an issue that is a very complex one, that is that there are a number of different aspects that people seek to becoming informed on and wish to inquire into and discuss in depth with experts. And the library has tried to bring a range of experts to enable that discussion and that information, which is the very first part of the library's responsibility under the Act to provide information. Our speaker today is Professor Bob Williamson, who became the Professor of Molecular Genetics and Biochemistry at St Mary's Hospital Medical School at the University of London in 1976, and happily in 1995 moved to Melbourne to be Director of the Murdoch Institute and Professor of Medical Genetics. He's been involved in the identification of genes for cystic fibrosis, heart disease and Alzheimer's disease, and he's known for his commitment to application of medical research to improve community health and to achieve economic benefits for Australia through biotechnology. He retired in October 2004 and is now Honorary Principal Fellow of the Murdoch Institute and Professor at the University of Melbourne. He has many publications and has had a distinguished scientific career and is a Fellow of the Academy of Science, the Royal Society and an Officer of the Order of Australia. So welcome, Professor Williamson.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. This is an important issue, and it's an important issue because it's not a simple one. It's a complicated one. It brings into focus a number of streams that are of importance to our community. It brings into focus the medical hopes of millions of people, the hope that we can develop new forms of treatment for diseases like cancer and heart disease. I may say, as a medical researcher for the past 45 years, much of my career has been spent working on very rare diseases. And one of the interesting things about this issue is one of the first times that the diseases we're talking about, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, cancer, are diseases that affect millions of Australians and hundreds of millions of people throughout the world. We're talking about the scientific aspirations of our country. We're talking about empowerment of our people, because research is about empowerment. And we're talking about the ethical concerns of our community. And unlike many issues, I actually don't talk down or disrespect the views of other people here. I think that one of the interesting things about this field is that many of us simultaneously have concerns about medical advancement, concerns about scientific research, concerns about the ethics. And obviously, scientists and doctors spend many hours thinking about ethics. Can I just make a point? So far as I'm concerned, within reason, if anyone has any questions they want to ask me, I'm very happy for you to interrupt and shout out and all that sort of thing. I think that most lay people are very concerned about the ethical implications. They desperately want to see new and successful forms of treatment for heart disease, cancer, etc. But they're worried about slippery slopes. They're worried about ethical values. And I think it's partly what we're talking about as a nation, is balancing these concerns against each other. My own track record, I've worked in medical research for 45 years. I was involved in, probably my group was the first group to clone medically relevant human genes. These were the genes for thalassemia, beta globin, alpha globin genes. Then worked on cystic fibrosis, Alzheimer disease, and heart disease for many years. I've been a professor at Imperial College London University and at Melbourne University for the past 30 years till I retired. I'm chair of the National Committee for Medicine of the Australian Academy of Science. I'm a fellow of the Royal Society. And I do actually write on ethical issues. There's a book for the library here. I co-authored a book called Ethical Issues in Genetic Research. I've been on the board of the Journal of Medical Ethics for the past 15 years. I actually take some pride in the fact that I've had a continuing interest both in the regulation of genetics and also in its ethical content. Now, I prepared a handout that's on the sheet, and I do want to make one point on the data. The Australian Academy of Science is the peak body for scientists in Australia. And when we look at things, one of the things we do is we actually try to assess the significance of what we're reading in terms of where it appears. Now, the library has done a very good job, but for instance, here's Nature. Nature is the top scientific journal in the world, and Nature did a section on stem cell research in June, which is available for any of you from the library. And this is not one-eyed stuff. This is not people who say we're for stem cell research and we're against stem cell research. These are balanced reports from all of the top places in the world. They're not composed of people who have an absolute commitment. And I'd suggest that people, if possible, have a particular look at Nature, Science, New England Journal of Medicine, where there are all kinds of articles that are available. I'll just start out by saying very briefly what are stem cells. I'm sure most of you already know about this. Adult stem cells are cells that come from someone who is already alive. It may surprise you to know that fetal stem cells are actually called adult stem cells. So are stem cells from newborn babies. So cord blood stem cells are adult stem cells. Indeed, it's actually very hard to get stem cells from real adults, because you get fewer and fewer of them as you get older, which is actually one of the big problems that we face when it comes to therapy. Not everyone, some of the people here look quite young, but for many of us, we're actually thinking, what a stem cell is going to mean for us. So one of the problems with adult stem cells is the fact that you have fewer and fewer of them as time goes on. I actually work on cord blood cells, which are a form of adult stem cell, and cystic fibrosis. So why do embryonic stem cells matter? Embryonic stem cells come from an embryo. Usually they come from an early embryo. And in Australia, it has been legal for the past 4 years to obtain embryonic stem cells from spare embryos that are left over from IVF. These embryos have not been created for research. They've been created as part of the IVF procedure for very good medical reasons. Now, embryonic stem cells have two incredibly important properties from the point of view of the researcher. One is that they can generate any cell type. Now, obviously, everyone in this room, there's no one here is a clone, no. Everyone in this room started as a single embryonic stem cell. And we have skin cells, brain cells, liver cells, all of these cells, and they've all come from that original single stem cell. So embryonic stem cells have this incredible capacity to give us all cell types reasonably easily. Adult stem cells do not have that capacity. Adult stem cells do give rise to cells, but if you take liver stem cells from an adult, they generate liver cells preferentially. And indeed, no one has really been able to prove, in spite of enormous attempts, and I'll come back to this in a minute in relation to heart disease, no one's been able to use adult stem cells to make cell types, to transdifferentiate into cell types other than the ones you start from. And that's a problem. Embryonic stem cells also have the capacity to multiply and multiply and multiply. They're the only cells we know that can multiply indefinitely. So for instance, if you work on cystic fibrosis as I do, one of the biggest problems with using adult stem cells is the fact that I can't get enough of them from a kid with cystic fibrosis to use them clinically. It's really a very, very major issue, whereas embryonic stem cells keep multiplying. What are the downsides? Downsides are simple. The embryonic stem cell from any spare IVF embryo, if it was used to treat you or me or the kids with cystic fibrosis I work with, would be rejected. It's immunologically different from that child. So clearly, it wouldn't be possible to take some anonymous embryonic stem cell and use it for treatment. It's just not on. The second problem is that we know that embryonic stem cells, and I should say some adult stem cells, can cause cancer. So we have a bit of a difficulty. Obviously, one could not use a cell for therapy unless it were guaranteed to be safe. Guaranteeing that something is safe is the role of the TGA. Everyone in this parliament knows the fact that the TGA do. There's no way the TGA would allow stem cells to be used. Whereas we do know that bone marrow stem cells and cord blood stem cells are reasonably safe to use because they've already been used in several thousand therapies for leukemia and similar diseases. I should also just make one point here. The very first experiments with bone marrow stem cells were made 40 years ago. And Don Thomas won the Nobel for bone marrow transplantation 18 years ago. The very first human ES cells were only available 4 or 5 years ago. There's been very much less work done on them. So the fact that we don't yet know how to do something in science is an argument for more research. I do, however, have to say that pretending that therapy is going to be available next week or next month is just so much hype in relation to much of what we're talking about. We really have to be realistic and see that what we're talking about here is research that I believe will lead to new forms of treatment, but lead to it in 5, 10, 15 years' time. Now, the Lockup Committee was established as a result of the 2002 Acts as an expert committee to review the legislation. It had 6 members representing law, ethics, science, and medicine. It happened to have a preponderance, at least 5 out of 6, and I think 6 out of 6 are actually observing Christians, which is considerably more than would be true for this house or for the community out there. So the Lockup Committee was, if anything, a conservative committee in its composition in relation to ethics. The Lockup Committee sat on this issue for 6 months, reviewed 1,000 submissions, took all evidence from 100 organizations and individuals, and came up with a unanimous report with recommendations that will be before you as a result of Senator Patterson's bill. So we're not dealing here with a committee of people who were picked up off the street or anything. You know, these are the national experts, including Barry Marshall, who just won the Nobel Prize. You know, these are significant individuals. There has been some discussion of whether there are new data. Professor Sir Gustav Nossal and Professor Graham Mitchell have just reviewed the data and have issued a document which is available, and I think again it will be available through the Parliamentary Library, which states that there is an enormous amount of new data. Let's see if I can find, here it is. As indicated, it is our firm opinion that recent advances in this technically challenging, highly regulated field have been very substantial and are worthy of notice. 12th of September, Sir Gustav Nossal, Graham Mitchell. And there's a 20-page article here showing the sorts of things that have been found. Now,
can I just ask a quick question?
Sure.
Being new to this and not being familiar with the committee, but on the committee, were there scientists who were in the areas of stem cell biology?
There were people who are human molecular geneticists, but I believe it was a conscious decision that was made not to have anyone who was actually in the field of stem cell biology. However, the committee spent 6 months virtually full time taking evidence from groups, including the Australian Academy of Science, which of course does include many people in the field, also the Australian Stem Cell Centre, but also people like Jack Martin, who some of you heard yesterday, who is an opponent of somatic cell nuclear transfer and embryonic stem cell research. I don't think that anyone who sat through the proceedings, I only sat through the Melbourne ones, would claim that the committee was anything but fair and balanced in the views that it took from the community. Peter Schofield is director of the Prince of Wales Institute in Sydney, and he's a notable human molecular geneticist. I don't think he actually works directly on stem cells. Now, when it comes to new information, I don't really want to go through everything, but let's take an example. Judy Chang, working with YW Khan, has shown that it's possible to correct the mutation for sickle cell anemia. Sickle cell anemia and thalassemia, there are approximately 300 million, 400 million carriers. There are approximately 12 million people affected by this disease. If we can correct that mutation in stem cells from these people, whether by somatic cell nuclear transfer or by adult stem cells, we are going to have a fantastic ability to treat people, and not only to treat people in Australia or the States, but to treat people in West Africa, to treat people in Greece and Cyprus, to treat people in Southeast Asia. So it's incredibly important data, and that was in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in January 2006. Articles on nuclear cloning of embryonal cancer cells, which are addressing the issues of what's going on in cancer. Liz Blackburn, an Australian who's working at the University of California, San Francisco, and has just won the most prestigious award of the American Society for Human Genetics, is working on the way in which telomeres, those sequences at the ends of chromosomes, shorten and lengthen using both adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells. The real reason we need embryonic stem cell research is not because embryonic stem cells are going to be the immediate choice for therapy. It's to learn how adult stem cells can be treated in order to make them grow, multiply, and make the kinds of cells we want. Embryonic stem cells have that ability, and we need that. We also need to study rejection. We need to study what's going on immunologically. If we don't know what's going on immunologically, we can't actually deal with stem cells for therapy. Why is somatic cell nuclear transfer important? Because if I'm talking to a family who have a 2-year-old with cystic fibrosis, I cannot take the lungs from that 2-year-old in order to find out how to avoid immune rejection if we can replace the CF mutation with a normal cystic fibrosis gene. I need the ability to do that in the test tube, in the laboratory. And I'll just make the point that one of Lockhart's first and most important conclusions was that we keep the ban on human reproductive cloning. The penalty for human reproductive cloning in Australia is 15 years in prison. I live in a world where punishment usually means they take a bit of your grant away from you. You know, the idea of 15 years in prison being a punishment, this is serious stuff. And there's no way in which anyone in academia is going to risk that sort of penalty and the opprobrium that comes with it. Now, somatic cell nuclear transfer, you're all familiar with. Basically, you take an oocyte, an egg cell, from a woman, and you take a skin cell or a liver cell or some other cell, you take all of the genetic material that matters out of the egg, you pop in the nucleus from the skin cell or the liver cell or whatever cell you're using, you give it an electric shock, and then it multiplies up And in the laboratory, you let it multiply up, say, to about 100 cells, and you take the cells out of the middle of it, and you put them in a nice nourishing media, and you let them multiply. This is somatic cell nuclear transfer. I do not believe this is giving an embryo. I'll be absolutely definitive about that. I dare say most of you, like me, have died of four children. The great thing about having children is that they are not identical to you genetically. They're a mixture. They're a mixture of your partner's genes, your genes, mixed up together, like you, but different from you. They have their own genetic identity. They have their own social context. They're the product of a relationship that wants a continuation of the family, of the commitment that's involved in that. And they have a biological singularity. A somatic cell nuclear transfer cell has no genetic identity. It is just like a cell grown in culture from any of us. It has no social context, and it has a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of a biological identity if someone decides to risk 15 years in prison by putting it into the womb of a woman. My view is that as long as these cells stay in the laboratory in the Petri dish, they do not represent an ethical hazard. But it's actually more than that, and I'm sure my colleague from MIT will have comments on this in the discussion time. It's more than that. One of the things we're finding out, ironically, largely from Rudy Ainsch's group, also in Boston, is that if you culture normal cells, skin cells, liver cells, brain cells from any of us, and you culture them in a way such that you introduce the cytoplasm or various other factors from embryonic stem cells or other ways of turning the clock back, you can make them the more or less equivalent of the cells you get from somatic cell nuclear transfer. Now this, it seems to me, is a really important point, because the people who argue against somatic cell nuclear transfer as a laboratory method of studying what we want to do are going to find, I think, that in a year or two, we generate identical cells from any of us at any time. And those cells have the same potential to give rise to an embryo as somatic cell nuclear transfer cells. And when that happens, the whole ethical argument shifts, because those have not come from an egg or a sperm. Now, my feeling on somatic cell nuclear transfer as to why we need it, I personally think we need it, and I'll give an example, because all of you know it. Type 1 diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes. There is an epidemic of type 1 diabetes in Australia. There is roughly 3 times the amount of type 1 diabetes today as there was 20 years ago, and all of you who are members and those of you who are staffers will now know someone or other who has a child with type 1 diabetes, with insulin-dependent diabetes. When those kids present in pediatrics, the cells that make insulin in their pancreas are dead. That's the reason why they have type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is not a genetic disease. Because it's not a genetic disease, we cannot use surplus IVF embryos, even if they've been diagnosed, because we can't diagnose type 1 diabetes in an embryo. We need to know why those cells have died in order to work out ways to prevent them dying. I think that somatic cell nuclear, if you would ask me the one thing I would want to do quickly, I would want to take a cell from a young woman with type 1 diabetes, put it into her own egg. So it's a good idea to use her own egg, because that gives you an identical, totally identical genetic construct. Even the mitochondria, the energy factories, are the same. And then get cells that are differentiating into the beta islet cells in the pancreas and see how to keep them alive. What's going wrong? Why are they dying? How can we keep them alive? Same thing for motor neuron disease. Same sort of problem in motor neuron disease. We need to know why those brain cells are dying, and we don't know at the moment. We don't have any way of finding out. So somatic cell nuclear transfer is a research tool. And if you look at the articles in the New England Journal of Medicine, the articles in the New England Journal of Medicine that appeared on September 21st showed something really interesting. They showed that stem cells, adult stem cells in this case, adult stem cells can be used to inject into people with heart attacks. Now, I was just talking to someone a few minutes ago and making the point, we all care about cystic fibrosis, we care about thalassemia, we care about all of these disorders, but the truth is, half the people in this room are going to have a heart attack. It affects us. We're actually directly involved in this heart attack research. And here we have three articles which leave more questions than answers. Really, read the articles. They give slightly positive results. They show that these adult stem cells cannot form heart muscle. Big problem with adult stem cells. They can't form heart muscle because they're from the bone marrow. They can form bone marrow, but they can't form heart muscles. But when these are used in this case, we need to know more about it. One of the ways we can find out more about it, ironically, even though we would never use somatic cell nuclear transfer cells to treat heart disease, we will find out the information we need to know about how to use adult stem cells from somatic cell nuclear transfer. And we particularly read the article by Bob Schwartz, The Politics and Promise of Stem Cell Research, who makes the point about embryonic stem cell research. Tens of thousands of fertilized eggs will be destroyed without a single one being permitted to contribute to our knowledge of cell differentiation. That's what it's about. That's what the debate is about. And so I really suggest people have a look at that New England Journal article. Now, coming to the end of my talk, how many eggs will be needed? As of now, no one has ever done somatic cell nuclear transfer successfully with humans. So one could argue it might be 10 eggs, it might be 1,000 eggs. We don't know. The Koreans were criminals, and we have no idea how many eggs they actually used, because we have no idea. Once someone is a fraud in science, that's it. If you're a fraud in science, you're a criminal, and you're out of it. We don't know whether they did anything. By dog, sheep, mouse experiment, I actually don't, for what it's worth, I don't actually think animal experiments are always the best indicator for humans. And I don't necessarily read from animal experiments into humans. But the dog, sheep, and mouse experiments would indicate it might take between 20 and 200 eggs to generate a somatic cell nuclear transfer line. I personally believe that volunteers for this should not be paid or sought from the community. I believe there is a possibility of exploitation. And that's why my personal feeling is that the people who should be turned to first for volunteers are people who are affected by the disease in their families. So in the case of type 1 diabetes, there are lots of young women with type 1 diabetes who would be very keen indeed to participate in experiments to generate cell lines using their eggs and their cells in order to find out more about their disease and advance attempts for treatment in that area. And the same is true in cystic fibrosis, the same is true in motor neuron disease. I think the possibility for exploitation is something that does have to be taken seriously. What about animal eggs? There's been a lot of rubbish talked about animal eggs, you know. We're all brought up on this mythology, you know, Greek mythology of things that are part human and have a lion's head, all this stuff. It ain't like that. The truth is, if you mix genetic material between species, anything that you have, even if anyone were willing to risk 15 years in prison, which is the sentence you'd get for doing this, even if anyone were willing, it wouldn't work. Because mixtures, interspecific mixtures, hardly ever work in practice. Very, very, there are only one or two examples that are so rare that they stand out in biology. UK scientists have just applied for permission to use rabbit eggs in somatic cell nuclear transfer experiments. Why? Not because they want rabbits and humans as cells together, but because if I were training my postdoc, if I were training my technician, if I were training my student how to do this, I would not want to start with human eggs. Human eggs are precious. Human eggs, for me and for most of us, have an ethical content. Rabbit eggs do not. And in fact, the real reason for approving the use of animal eggs is for community-based ethical reasons, not for scientific reasons. There's no benefit. In fact, to be honest, it would be much harder to interpret the results of any experiments that were done that had a mixture of species. That's not what's wanted. What's wanted is an opportunity to train so that precious human eggs are not wasted. Well, I've been talking on behalf of the Academy, but I just want to make one final point, partly on behalf of the Academy and partly on my own behalf. I was in London a week ago, and I was talking to the people there, not just in science, but in government a bit, in the Department of Health. The United Kingdom, the United States, Singapore, all have rules which mirror the Lockhart Committee rules or are more lenient than the Lockhart Committee rules. There's no legislative control in most of the United States on this at all. The only rule in the United States is you're not allowed to use federal money. In fact, you wouldn't do it, but we could set up Spirling and Williamson, Inc., and provided we didn't use federal money, you know, we could do it with virtually anything. And that's the problem in America, is actually really that although people posture and say this is not allowed, the truth is it is allowed. In the UK, you're allowed to create embryos for research, which is not proposed by Lockhart and not supported by the Australian Academy of Science. We actually don't think that's necessary. I am worried, however, at the fact that Martin Pera and Paul Simmons left Australia. Now, I'm a new Australian. I'm very proud to be a new Australian, but I came here 12 years ago. And God knows, I'm not against international exchange of people. But I get worried when people tell me they're leaving Australia because they find the environment in the UK or the United States more able to carry out the research they want to do because of the legislation here. That worries me. I'm worried when politicians in the UK say to me, hey, is it really the religious beliefs of your minister that's determining what medical research is moving forward or not? Now, I respect Tony Abbott, I respect the other people who have strong views on this, and those views are views that they certainly have a right to and a right to be respected for. But that's different from using those views to determine the medical research policy of the whole country. I think we have a bloody good ethics system in Australia. We have an ethics system in Australia which is in many ways a model for the rest of the world. The NHMRC and our Human Research Ethics Committee and our Australian Health Ethics Committee are seriously regarded as important. And my personal view is that we really should be deciding our medical research policy based on the needs of medical research and the health needs of Australia, the research needs of Australia, our ability to participate in an international effort such as this. I'm really worried that we will be legislating ourselves out of the action in this field if we don't adopt Lockhart, because the United States, the United Kingdom, Singapore, the other countries have chosen to go down that path. And I think it's very dangerous for us not to do so. So the Academy of Science, which is the peak body in Australia, is firmly supportive of the Lockhart Committee report. We're firmly supportive of Senator Patterson's legislation. And we hope that every member of Parliament will actually think about this. We are available as an academy. We are available as individuals for any of you who want to talk to us about any of these issues. But we hope that Australia will be able to join with the United States and the United Kingdom in advancing what could be a very promising field of medical research. Thanks very much. Stop. First, then second.
Yeah, just a couple of comments. You talk a lot about the UK and about Britain and about Singapore, but there are many other countries, of course, that have chosen to leave very stringent safeguards in place against cloning and this sort of technologies. Significant amongst them is a country with a very interesting history in medical research, Germany. And they are losing scientists, but they show no signs of changing things. So I just say to you that there are other countries, respected countries, hardly backwaters, that are preeminent in a whole area of research and so forth, that have chosen not to embrace the UK or American model, and I think that's significant, if I may say so. Secondly, can I say to you that as one who is trying to understand the science of all this, but also, of course, has a worldview, I mean, we all bring a worldview to the table, I find it a bit glib, frankly, to say that a person's ethical considerations when they have to think these things through, not to restrict science. I don't hear scientists in this country berating the absolutely irrational position that governments have taken in relation to genetic modification and research in animals and livestock. But we have allowed the most absurd and irrational restrictions to take place there. And I hear relative silence on it. And I have enormous ethical difficulties with the idea that we are apparently saying, if the scientists say we ought to play with human DNA, with human genetics and so forth, that's fine, let's go for it. But oh no, we can't explore the real possibilities for better environmental outcomes, for more sustainability in agriculture, better options for giving people better nutrition and so forth, and no one seems to raise a peep out of it. We are very inconsistent on this stuff. We really are. I just want to make those general points. But to come to the other issue that I was interested in, one of the things that I can't get my mind around in terms of the Lockhart review is that in this country we've glibly said, no, we needn't worry about the supply of eggs, that won't be a problem, there won't be any farming, there won't be any inducement, the law doesn't allow it, and anyway we don't need it. But the British experience, as explained by an academic who's preeminent in this field last week, is that this has become a huge issue in Britain, and he doesn't run away from it. He says, yes, we need far more than we can get. There are all sorts of issues with coercion and so forth. Lockhart, Peter Schofield's sort of response to that was, we'd neatly sidestep that problem. We can simply go for the animal material. At least that's my understanding of what he's recommending, saying Lockhart's found a way around it. What strikes me as amazing as a non-scientist about this is that I would have thought that by the time you've mixed human genetic material with an animal genetic material, you've got something that's completely different. For the life of me, I can't see how that would be useful or applicable for human research. That's the point that I'd particularly just like to ask you to address.
Several points there. Thank you. On the last point first, I actually agree with you. I think I said the same thing. In terms of research outcomes, mixing species is really something that is likely to create more problems than it will solve. The real reason for permitting the use of animal eggs in this context is for training. I for one, don't work on embryonic stem cells, but I know people who do. And certainly, if I were training a technician or training a postdoc, the idea of using precious human ova for doing that would be ridiculous. And so one would want to use it for training. And there are certain very simple experiments. There's things that were done called capitation, working out whether a cell is capable of switching on a nucleus or not. And this was done with sperm and hamster eggs. It's being done now with cow eggs and human cells.
Are you aware, by the way, that you can't bring hamsters into Australia?
Yes, I am. No, I know, we can't do that. I know, we're the only place in the world that doesn't use hamster eggs for this. But these are the sorts of things I see it for. I think that at the end of the day, the other thing, I'm not disagreeing with what Peter said. After all, he's in Lockhart. He was on Lockhart and I wasn't. But
I may be misunderstanding.
No, you're not misunderstanding him at all. My feeling is the real difference is actually not there. I think the real difference is the fact that any experiment that's proposed that involves somatic cell nuclear transfer in Australia has three safeguards. In the first place, it has to go through the NHMRC Embryo Licensing Committee. In the second place, it has to go through a human research ethics committee. And in the third place, it's done in an environment where you spend 15 years in prison if you violate the law and try to put it into the womb of a woman. In the United States, there is no legislation that makes it illegal in most states. In Britain, there is no overarching ethical framework of the same importance as in this country. So I actually think that, and I've worked in the States and I've worked in Britain, and it seems to me that we're in a better position to cope with these advances than either of those countries. Having said that, I actually suspect that human-animal hybrids will not give us that much in the way of useful scientific information. What they will mean is that it's possible to reduce markedly the number of human ova that are required in order to do this. And I should also say that my view is that the number of somatic cell nuclear transfer experiments that I would regard as appropriate in research really revolve around things like type 1 diabetes, motor neuron disease, other conditions like this, and immune rejection. And this is in the research lab. We're not talking about therapy. The most misleading thing that has been said by people who, in general terms, agree with me has been to give a foreshortened view of the timing when this will become applicable in clinical medicine. I mean, this is not something for next week. On the other hand, if we look down the path 5, 10, 15 years ahead, if we don't participate in it, if we're not there, we will not have a seat at the table when it comes to participating in the clinical advances when they come. What really worries me, more than anything else, you know, if my postdocs and the postdocs who you meet go to the States and Britain and we don't attract people of comparable quality to come to Australia, our scientific research community will be the weaker. And when the time comes, we will not have the people and the resources who are able to really make use of this. On your other point about countries, sure, there are views of lots of countries. Not always what you'd predict. Germany and Italy have very strict rules against somatic cell nuclear transfer. Brazil and Spain, Brazil's the largest Roman Catholic country in the world, Brazil and Spain have very permissive laws that permit somatic cell nuclear transfer. There are all kinds of contradictions out there. However, as someone who is chair of the National Committee for Medicine of the Academy, we are used, as you are in this house, we are used to comparing ourselves with the United States and Britain when it comes at least to our scientific aspirations, and I think that's appropriate. Do you want to take it? You should.
No,
yes,
please. Professor Williamson, I'm just a little bit confused about how different people in this debate are actually defining what is an embryo. I've got the impression that Lockhart actually thought that a human embryo clone was an embryo, was a human embryo. Then I think I heard you say, and I think you're saying, that the result of a somatic cell nuclear transfer, nuclear technology, that process is in fact not going to lead to a human embryo. So in a sense, am I right, you're probably disagreeing with that part of Lockhart. And then to the question, the real question is, you know, if that's the case, if somatic cell nuclear transfer, it doesn't lead to an embryo. Now, what happened with Dolly the sheep? Because it was a result of that process. And people usually thought it was an embryo. So you're now saying it was never an embryo, aren't you? And if that's the case, what was it? Mm. I mean, I suppose that's the point. Can we tie down a little bit more about... And this goes to the last one also. I think you said the Academy doesn't support research... human embryos being created for research. But that statement is predicated on the definition of the embryo that you state.
Yes. These are good points and valid points. Lockhart stated in its considerations that it regarded whether somatic cell nuclear transfer cells were embryos or not as a matter of high controversy. Obviously, Dolly the sheep argues that they are. Obviously, the fact that no one has ever succeeded in taking such a cell into the test tube, even, never mind anywhere else, in humans, argues that they're not. And it's a controversial area. However, I would make two points on this. I don't totally agree with Lockhart. I would rather not define it as an embryo. My reason is twofold. The first is it doesn't have a genetic identity or a social context. And I think common sense, at least for me, says that genetic identity and social context are very, very important parts of individuality. This is in ethics terms. Yeah. In ethics terms, the reason why I am opposed to cloning ethically, human reproductive cloning ethically, the reason I'm opposed to it is because it diminishes autonomy. And it diminishes autonomy because of that absence of genetic individuality. Sorry, probably, I don't know if anyone else is interested in this stuff or not, but this is sort of hard ethics stuff. Things that diminish autonomy are by definition ethically questionable. And it seems to me that here we're dealing with a process that would diminish autonomy. However, the new data, the reason why I really disagree with this has to do with the new data. You have to some extent, define things in terms of potential. Potential is not everything. Origin is something, and whether something originates from a real egg sperm embryo or not is important. I mean, the irony is that most of you probably know where I'm coming from. Although I don't agree with the people who are opposed to the use of spare IVF embryos for research, I actually have more sympathy with that view. There's a spare IVF embryo is actually an egg sperm embryo. It's an embryo that could result in someone like us, so to speak, than with opposition to somatic cell nuclear transfer. Somatic cell nuclear transfer will give a diploid cell, what we would call a diploid cell in culture, derived from the individual from whom that somatic cell nucleus was taken. And potential now is beginning to reside in those cells with the clock wind back. And for those who are taking the position, which by implication I assume you're taking, can I put to you, not you personally obviously, but people with that, can I put to you, what happens in a year's time when scientists at MIT have developed the trick to take any cell in culture and give it that Dolly potential? Because that's going to happen. That's going to happen. And as soon as that happens, you have no difference in potential between the somatic cell nuclear transfer cell and the cell from your skin or your liver or anything. And I think that's an important ethical point if one argues in terms of potential. But I don't think the ethical, anyone wants to, I've actually written a couple of articles in the Journal of Medical Ethics about this, but I don't think it's a simple point. And obviously, the possibility of a Dolly-type procedure, because after all, we have a lunatic Italian gynecologist called Antonori who is threatening to do this. Does everyone know? He says he has 1,000 women lined up, all of whom want to participate in cloning, all of whom want to clone their husbands. Isn't this absolutely remarkable? Anyway, we do have lunatics in the world.
My wife will be lining up.
We do have lunatics in the world who are thinking in those terms. Having said that, I would say on balance that while I understand very much the objection, although I don't agree with it, the objection to working with what I call egg sperm embryos, I really don't think somatic cell nuclear transfer comes in the same category.
Okay. The recent work, Professor Greens, and the recent work in Japan where they took a body somatic cell from a mouse and reprogrammed it with 4 proteins, I think it was, and then implanted it and found it produced 3, ectoderm, endoderm, and mesoderm.
Yes.
Do you think that sort of research, is that very close to the stuff you're talking about in MIT, that may produce an embryo, something that behaves like an embryo, whether we'd call it an embryo or not, firstly, and does that then accentuate the problem you're saying, that if its origin is from that source, do we then give it the same status as an embryo? But the other thing I wanted to ask was, or say as a comment, was that the Lockhart Review used the NHMRC definition of embryo. One of the reasons they did that was, I think, so that people couldn't fuzz or fudge what was an embryo and do research outside saying, well, this is not really an embryo, and maybe do some things that we as a community might think was improper and appropriate. And I think they chose that broader definition to ensure that it would have much better oversight. And I think they would argue too that they don't necessarily think that that's the way to define it, but to keep the research controllable and also transparent. That was a better way to do it and to keep with the NHMRC definition. I presume NHMRC did, because in that booklet they've also gone through the different ways in which embryo or embryo-like clusters could be initiated.
Yeah. Thank you for that reminder. Lockhart chose a consensus conservative way to deal with the issue. And I think Lockhart, I can't speak for them, I wasn't on the committee though, I gave evidence to them. I think Lockhart felt that starting the argument that you raised would actually create more problems, and they wanted to focus on some of the practical outcomes and not on definitions. My feeling is that in the long run, I actually think in the long run they may make more problems than they solve by avoiding the issue, but that's because we're in a rapidly moving field. We're in a field that's moving sort of virtually week by week. The paper that Senator Patterson was referring to, here it is, Simple Recipe Gives Adult Cells Embryonic Powers. It's an important paper, because if adult cells have the powers that embryonic stem cells have, then what happens to the argument about the uniqueness of somatic cell nuclear transfers creating an embryo if every cell in our body has that potential? Certainly the Japanese paper is important in this, but remember, it's with mice. One of the difficulties is that although mice represent a starting point, they're not actually the perfect model for humans. Mice are inbred. The reason why mice are used in laboratories is because genetically, in our mouse house at the Murdoch, every mouse was exactly the same as every other mouse. That meant you could do an experiment and you knew it was your experiment that was making the difference. Look around the room. We're outbred. We are all different. And it's those differences that make it difficult to extrapolate from mouse to humans. What they're doing in Rudy Enish's lab is mixing the cytoplasm of cells that have one potential to differentiate with the nuclei of cells that have a different and more restricted potential to differentiate, and showing that by using some of those chemical factors that switch on broader totipotency, you're able to make an ordinary skin cell very much more like an embryonic stem cell. They haven't yet succeeded in making an embryonic stem cell from a skin cell, but that work is moving extremely rapidly. And obviously, this is in the parliamentary library and copies of these papers. Now, make a point about papers. In the debate, and I'm not saying this just in favor of my point of view, I suggest that one of the things all of us should do is to distinguish a paper in Nature or a paper in New England Journal from papers that are somewhere else, if you know what I mean. I mean, the top journals are really extraordinarily responsible. And if you're getting articles, I mean, all of the articles I've quoted are from MIT or University of California, San Francisco, or Oxford, or places like that. And the reason is that these are good places, you know. And not everyone, and once again, on the Nature articles, you'll notice that at least four of the eight articles comment that there are pros and cons in doing embryo experiments. We don't know. We're at the beginning of a scientific adventure. I just want to guarantee that Australia's part of that scientific adventure and doesn't rule itself out. Incidentally, I don't disagree with the fact that ministers or anyone, senators or representatives, have a right to sort of state their point of view as an ethical point of view. Obviously, everyone's ethical point of view will influence the way they look at this issue. What I'm saying is that when it comes to the way a nation is going to craft its medical research agenda, there are overriding considerations, it seems to me. And eventually, when stem cell therapies become available for diseases other than leukemia, we have to ask ourselves, we're going to use them when, God forbid, you or I or any of us develop Alzheimer's or develop motor neuron disease or develop Parkinson's, and dare I say it, we will. Are we really going to say, we didn't participate in doing this because of our views, but we're going to import the technology to treat the disease? Because there's no way we are not going to use those technologies when they become available.
Thank you.
You'll have to.
Professor Benton, thanks very much. I'm glad that you mentioned the prestige that Nature has. You'd be aware, of course, that they had an editorial earlier in the year called Playing the Name Game around scientists who, I suppose, talk about embryos not as if they're embryos, such as, and you've made a distinction between sperm egg embryos and embryos created through SCMT, and I gather that you prefer not to use that word in relation to SCMT. But Nature was fairly damning of scientists who tried to fudge that distinction, saying that they're in danger of being accused of not wanting to engage in the ethical issues.
Yeah, Nature had an editorial which made some of those points. It didn't make them, not quite as black and white a way as that. It put a number of points of view. I think that at this stage, I'm supporting Lockhart on behalf of the Academy, and Lockhart chose to use the definition that Nature would have approved of. I am making the point because most of you are going to be participating in this debate not only this month, but in 3 years' time, is this debate is not going to go away. And in a sense, what I really would say is watch this space. What I'm also saying is that I personally do make a distinction. I do not call an egg sperm embryo that is surplus to IVF an entity or something like that. It's an embryo. It's a real embryo with real potential. It needs to be seen that way, and I give it an element of respect because of that. But you're quite right. I would personally not do so for a somatic cell nuclear transfer, not because I'm trying to obfuscate or dodge the issue, but because I genuinely believe that if we took a cell from you and immortalized it in that way, that it would cease to be a cell from you and become an embryo. That's my personal view. I think it's an important point and one we can continue to discuss and debate. If I were someone of Roman Catholic faith, I would be genuinely concerned about the fact that I would feel I was at risk of painting myself into a corner as more and more cells have the potential to become embryos as we learn more and more scientifically about how to do it. But I don't disagree with your point.
Not mine, it was Nature's.
Are there any more questions or comments? Well, I think this has been a very timely presentation. I think the thing that you've said that most resonates is that these are very, very complex issues, and that many of the questions, in fact, have revealed layers of that complexity which will be worked through in the next couple of months. And I'd like to ask everyone to thank you for your contribution to the debate.
Between coal, two coals, and two coals.